Let's look at the Schiller piece on the sublime first, and then after the break, we'll look at Flannery O'Connor's essay on the grotesque. Schiller was enormously influenced by Kant, as the subtitle towards the further development of Kantian themes. And his philosophy really is just a kind of application, extension of Kant's basic framework. The most famous work in aesthetics that Schiller wrote is a treatise called Letters on the Aesthetic Education of Man, or On the Aesthetic Education of Man, which is written as a set of letters. Originally was written as a set of letters, but then he transformed it into this book. It's one of the great works of German idealism. This essay on the sublime, I think, is the clearest statement of Kant's views on the sublime, enriched with many different examples, enriched also by a real dramatist's flair. It's fairly rigorous and carefully written, but it's quite clear compared to Kant, and occasionally even poetic. So let's look at the first page. It gives a very nice initial definition of the sublime. We call an object sublime if, whenever the object is presented or represented, our sensuous nature feels its limits, but our rational nature feels its superiority, its freedom from limits. Thus, we come up short against the sublime object physically, but we elevate ourselves above it morally, namely through ideas. Aesthetics has always been accused of being obsessed with the beautiful. There's no question that that's true. Aesthetics is primarily fascinated with the beautiful. Yet it is true that we do experience a powerful attraction to phenomena we call sublime. Sublime phenomena are things that have a quality of unsettlingness, irritation, horror, even. At the same time, as we find them thrilling and elevating, how to capture and explain that strange duality of the sublime is a great difficulty. How is it that one can explain why we are drawn towards things that, at the same time that they elevate us, make us feel uncomfortable, make us feel shudders of dread? Why do people go to horror movies? I mean, that's sort of a banal example, but part of what's going on in horror movies is an attraction to things that are sublime. Why do people enjoy tragedy? One of the things that Schiller argues is that the tragic spectacle is generally sublime. It's not beautiful. It is genuinely attractive, and its attractiveness is best captured by sublimity rather than beauty. Because the sublime has this dual quality, this sinking feeling, this shuddering feeling, this feeling of fear and unease, at the same time there's a kind of exaltation and thrill, one has to come up with an interesting explanation for that duality. And what Schiller does, and what he followed Kant, is he argues that the sublime appeals to us in all of its duality because man himself is a dual being. There's a duality in us. On the one hand, there is our physical nature, which is what he calls our sensuous nature. It's our nature that is both sensible of the world around us, namely our bodies, and also known to us by our senses. We not only know things through our sensuous nature, but we know our sensuous nature sensuously. So we are aware of the body because of its work, its feelings, just as we are aware of other things through the body's feelings. And if this were all there were to man, we probably couldn't enjoy sublime things. Because, he says, that the sublime involves the feeling of limits on our sensuous nature. And if we were simply sensuous beings, it would be hard to explain why we would enjoy feeling our sensuous nature threatened or limited or constricted in some way or frustrated. There'd be nothing in it for us if we were simply sensuous beings. And so what Kant argues, Schiller follows him, is that man is more than a sensuous being. And Kant's solution to the problem of freedom and determinism is basically a kind of dualism. Kant believed that anything material was subject to Newtonian mechanistic laws. Everything was therefore determined. Yet man was free and morally responsible. Therefore, our freedom and moral responsibility had to belong to an aspect of ourselves, immaterial. If all material things are determined, and yet man is free and responsible, then our freedom and responsibility has to be here in some immaterial dimension of us, whatever that is. And therefore, man has a dual nature, a material and an immaterial nature. The sublime oppresses our material nature, but it thrills our immaterial nature. That's his argument. Now, Kant makes a distinction between two kinds of sublime, the mathematical and the dynamical. These are typically hideous Kant terms. Mathematical sublime. What does that mean? Well, Schiller, I think, redraws the distinction in much clearer terms by talking about the theoretical and the practical sublime. What Kant calls mathematical, Schiller calls theoretical. Now, what does this refer to? It refers to our cognitive faculties, our faculties of knowing or theorizing. And the basic core of it is this, that there are certain things in nature that cannot be represented by our senses, that can be thought by our intellects. Infinite space cannot be represented, but it can be thought. Anything extremely large challenges our powers of representation. To see something, we have to see some things against the background, right? And that means that we can only see things of a certain size easily. What if we encounter something that's enormous, gigantic, and sort of looms up over us and, in a sense, prevents itself from being fully an object because of its sheer magnitude? Kant argues that things that are enormous, things that are infinite, beyond enormous, break down the capacity of sense organs to perceive them. We can't perceive infinity, we can't perceive vastness. And therefore, they give us the experience of a limitation in our sensuous nature. Our physical sense organs simply can't grasp these things. They can't represent them or present them. However, our thoughts can grasp infinity. We understand what infinity means. And therefore, what Kant argues is that when we have an experience of a theoretical sublime, what's happening is that the feeling of limitation comes from the inability of our senses to capture something. Our mind boggles, or our senses boggle. Yet at the same time, we recognize that our intellects are equal to these things, that we can intellectually comprehend what we can't physically see, and there's a kind of thrill of the intellect's power being exercised that comes along with it. And therefore, we have the uplift. And examples of the mathematical sublime he gives are contemplating infinite space or infinite time. Or, Kant gives this example, entering a building like St. Peter's in Rome or approaching something extremely vast. And I've actually had this experience of the mathematical sublime. I remember once I was at Catholic University, and when I arrived there the first day, I was walking towards the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. The lawn was sort of a rise in it, so the base of the building was sort of concealed. But I couldn't really see there was a rise in the lawn, so I didn't really recognize that there was something going on. And the upshot was is that my sense of the building's size and location was entirely wrong. I thought, okay, it's just right over there. And I started walking, and after a few minutes I realized that I was nowhere near as close to the building as I thought I was, and it was nowhere near the size I thought it was. It was enormous. And there was a momentary kind of disorientation that I experienced that was kind of pleasurable until I realized that I was disoriented because I was operating under false assumptions about the size of the place and its location. But as soon as I came to recognize that, there was something pleasurable about it. And then that's the dynamic of the mathematics sublime, or the theoretical sublime. Or you're driving across a desert or something like that, and you think you're almost there, you keep driving, driving, see a mountain across the plain, you're driving towards, you think you're there, and it's not there. It almost seems to be constantly receding. Mount Kilimanjaro is supposed to be this way. It rises from this flat plain, and people keep thinking that they're almost there, and they keep going on and on and on and on, and they keep realizing that this is enormous. It's bigger than they dreamed. It's still miles and miles away until they finally reach the base. There's a similar mountain to that in China. These are good examples of the theoretical and mathematical sublime. Is this concept basically clear? I think that's a wonderful example. Anything where you contemplate great age, it has a quality that's mathematical sublime to it. You go into a forest where there are trees that have been standing for more than 1,000 years. One of my favorite scenes in Vertigo is the Redwood Forest north of San Francisco, where Madeline points to this tree that's a bell at the ring. She points to one point and says, "Here I was born, here I died," and in another ring. And it's really kind of chilling and extraordinary, because to locate one's own life within some vast stretch of time is kind of chilling. And there's something pleasurable about it, too. Tradition has a kind of sublimity to it. The sense that you're not just an isolated individual, but you're a link in some long chain. There is a kind of sublimity. The ancient families in Europe that can trace their lineages back dozens of generations, more than 1,000 years, they experience that as something sublime, right, and elevating. It puts a great deal of a burden on them to have to live up to a lot of ancestry. But yeah, I think that's a wonderful example. History is sublime. Great historical age is sublime. When you sit and contemplate how many generations have lived and died since a particular artifact was crafted that you're looking at in the museum, it gives you that strange sense. Frederick Bierstadt, an American 19th century painter. These 19th century landscape painters, these people who went west, these are painters who are associated with the sublime. And what they try and do is capture vast spaces, enormous magnitude. And the people who first saw these paintings were just astonished by the glimpses that they gave of the far west. Well, this brings us to the next sublime, the dynamical sublime, or what we call
practice.
A lot of music is sort of dynamically sublime, rather than mathematically sublime. So what is dynamical sublimity, or what Schiller calls practical sublimity? Well, it has to do not with our cognitive faculty, but with our moral faculty, or our moral nature. An object that's dynamically sublime is an object that can overwhelm or destroy our sensuous nature, not just escape being represented by it, but actually overwhelms and destroys it. And at the same time, we take pleasure in the fact that although physically we can be destroyed, he said morally we are innocent. Morally we are blameless, and we can take solace in our moral rectitude. I'm trying to think of a mathematical sublime in the sense that it boggles the mind. There are certain pieces that just come to mind by Scriabin that are sort of mind-boggling. They're sort of overwhelming, yet at the same time incredibly thrilling at the same time as they're overwhelming. They do sort of, they almost become painful in places, and they overwhelm the senses. There's a kind of intensity, I guess, that you can find in certain composers that sort of, I think, mathematically. It produces a kind of ecstatic state. I'm thinking of certain 20th century composers like Louis Swofsky and Duretsky. A lot of their stuff is noise, or sounds like noise, but some of it can be astonishingly beautiful. Or another composer like that is Messiaen. What they do that's mind-boggling, a tonal music is easy to comprehend, whereas atonal music is hard to comprehend. Okay, and so there are some kinds of music that sort of go beyond the limits of comprehensibility, and yet at the same time, if you follow it, it produces a kind of ecstatic state. It's not easy to comprehend, yet at the same time, if you do the work of following it, and even more importantly, if on the second time through you recognize these things, become familiar, it can produce a kind of ecstatic mental state. Missy Edens' music does that to me. He's this 20th century French composer, this extremely pious Catholic mystic who did all this piano music, orchestral music, combining bird song, and also oriental scales. So that, I think, would be mathematically sublime. It boggles your capacity to comprehend it easily, yet at the same time, if you follow it, there's a kind of feeling of transcendence that goes along with it. And I can see why Messiaen was kind of mystic. His music isn't beautiful. It's really hard to listen to. But if you force yourself to, it really produces an incredibly altered state of mind. And Penderecki is the same way, and so is Ludoslavski. You can't comprehend it with your senses, but intellectually you can. With somebody like, say, Messiaen, the comprehension of it really works through the memory. And even though your senses don't find it easy to just sort of follow along, it's not rhythmical, it doesn't return to a little key. It's not like a Mozart piece, which you instantly start humming. It's got hummable melodies. It doesn't have these things. Yet if you follow it and focus on it, you can use your memory to overcome the unintelligibility of it, the sensuous unintelligibility of it. And when you hear it again and recognize it again, especially then, it is enormously pleasurable and can produce this kind of odd, ecstatic state of mind. But it's not something you can do easily, and it's not something you can just pop on in the background. I can put on Mozart in the background and just sort of, Vivaldi and just do housework to it. It's pleasant. You know, every little bit I tune into is beautiful. You put this music on as background music, and it just gives you the creeps. You just have to turn it off. Because it demands, little bits and snatches. It just sounds like nothing. It demands your attention. If you won't give it the attention, it just makes you crazy. Again, your senses can't really follow it in an easy way, but your mind can somehow, on a higher level, grasp it. And that produces a kind of feeling of both limitation and frustration, but also exaltation and pleasure. And that's what the sublime is. Well, put it this way, there's a kind of higher order sublimity where you put the beautiful and sublime together. So you get the duality built into the sublime by juxtaposing beauty and sublimity. Let's talk about, though, this dynamic sublime. Again, the dynamic has to do with power. In Schiller's term, it's practical sublime. And practical sublime has to do with the experience. There's an experience of a threat to our physical survival combined with the sense that morally, we're more than equal to it. Right? Morally, we're innocent. Morally, we're deserving. And there are a number of dimensions to this, and he makes some very fine-grained distinctions that I'd like to point out. He says that sublimity involves a sense of mastering nature or of being above nature. But he says that there's nothing sublime about actually physically mastering nature. So it makes a distinction between the physical mastering of nature and the moral mastering of nature. Physical transcendence of nature and moral transcendence. Physical transcendence of nature is simply technological power. And so the response to being physically threatened is to push back physically. The rivers rise, so you dam them. And this is on page 27. The sublimity of our rational character, this our practical independence from nature, must indeed be distinguished from the sort of superiority that we know how to assert over nature as a power in individual instances, owing to either our physical or our intellectual powers. There is, of course, also something magnificent, but not at all sublime about this latter sort of superiority in itself. For example, a human being who struggles with a wild animal and subdues it by the strength of his arm or even by cunning, a raging river like the Nile, whose power is broken by dams, to which human intellect, by gathering its overflows in canal, can even transform from a destructive object into a useful one. A ship at sea that, by its ingenious design, is in a position to defy all the violence of the furious elements. In short, all those cases where by means of its inventive intellect the human being has forced nature to obey him and serve his aims, even where nature is superior to him as a power and is equipped to bring about his demise. All these cases, I say, do not awaken a feeling of the sublime. Instead, they awaken admiration, there's something magnificent, but they're not sublime. Although they have something analogous to it. And for that reason, in the aesthetic evaluation, they are also pleasing. Yet why are they not sublime, given the fact that they evidence the superiority of humans over nature? He's saying that the superiority here is a physical superiority, not a moral superiority. Sublimity requires an awareness that we're somehow better than nature. Not that we're stronger, but that we're better. Not that we have might, but that we have right. So at the top of 28, he talks about how the only sublime object is the object that is superior to us as natural being, but from which we feel ourselves absolutely independent as rational. And for Schiller, rational and moral are interchangeable here. As beings not belonging to nature, thus on the basis of this conception, all natural means employed by humans to withstand the power of nature are excluded category of the sublime. And he actually talks about a little further how mightiest natural force is less sublime to the degree to which it appears to be tamed by human beings. And it rapidly becomes sublime again as soon as it confounds human artifice. So he gives the example of a horse that when it's wild, it's sublime, when it's dangerous. When it becomes a plow horse, there's nothing sublime about it at all. However, he says, if the horse throws off the yoke and runs wild again, then it recovers its sublimity. And I think there's something true about that, that the sublime object has to be precisely unmastered by man physically, because the things that are mastered by us are not threatening to us. And it has to be a threat in some way in order to be sublime. So the mastery that we have to feel is not a physical mastery, but a kind of moral mastery, or a moral superiority. That's really what's ingredient in the sublime. He also talks about the relationship of sublimity and fear. And he says that although the feeling of the sublime has this kind of creepy, sinking, disturbing feeling to it, there's a threatening quality about the sublime. The fact of the matter is that you cannot be actually afraid of a sublime object. And if you think back to Kant, it's easy to see why. Because if you're actually afraid, you cannot be disinterested. A bull is a sublime creature. But not when it's charging at you. Then it's just a threat and you want to run away. You can't stand there and contemplate it as a magnificent aesthetic spectacle. You have to run. Okay, and so you become interested in your own survival. And he says that the survival instinct always in some way compromises the aesthetic perspective. When you're purely interested in practical things, you're not anymore an aesthetic spectator. So if you start fearing for your life, you can't be an aesthetic spectator. This writer, Ernst Junger, who wrote about the trench experiences in the First World War, talks about that. You know, at a certain point, you just stop worrying about dying because there's really nothing you can do. If you cower in that little hole over there, you're just as likely to have a shell fall on you as you are if you just go about your business normally. And that's really true. You can't calculate and control certain things like that when there are bullets whizzing all around you. And at a certain point, he has described how everybody sort of just gave up. Stopped worrying about it because it didn't do them any good. So what did they do? They just did their duties. They just went about their business. And he said at that point of complete despair, right, if you will, or complete acceptance of the situation, he found that the war became this sublime aesthetic spectacle. It was full of horror, but also beauty. He could reconcile himself to it aesthetically. At a certain point, when you stop worrying about your own survival in the midst of a disaster, then you can become an aesthetic spectator again, even though you are threatened. There are some kinds of threats that you simply can't control, so you might as well not worry about it. And once you stop worrying about it, you start seeing things differently. Freud talks about developing a neurotic relationship to death. You can put it in aesthetic language. We're all going to die. Give up on that illusion. If you have illusions about that, you might as well give them up now. We're all going to die. And once you really accept the inevitability of it, not just intellectually, but emotionally, and understand what that really means, a lot of people don't, then it's possible to take up an aesthetic or erotic relationship to death. It becomes interesting. I'm not going to hasten to it, but it becomes interesting, not just frightening. And it can become an aesthetic spectacle. The way that Schiller puts it here is that death can only be an aesthetic spectacle if in the back of our minds somewhere we think that we might survive it. Otherwise, it's too terrifying. Well, I don't know about that. Whether you think you might survive it or not, it's inevitable. And once you really think through the inevitability of it, it becomes possible to treat it as a kind of aesthetic phenomenon. And indeed, people have an aesthetic and erotic relationship with death that people have throughout all of human history. He says that if you really, really knew, it wouldn't be threatening at all. You have to have it as a kind of well-founded hope, perhaps, but not a conviction. A well-founded hope of survival after death, but not a conviction of it. Because if you were certain that death is just a minor transition in your life process, no worse than, you know, teething or something like that, then it just doesn't become particularly interesting. He's saying, but at the same time, you can't really find it sublime if you think it's just a total terrifying abyss. If it's totally terrifying, it can't be an aesthetic spectacle. But there are other ways of not being terrified of it besides having the assumption that, well, maybe it'll survive it. You know, that's really an interesting question. And this actually goes to things that Schiller says. He says, God can only be sublime if we know that he's just. Did Moses have reason to think that God was just? Because if he didn't, then it would be just terrifying. I think Schiller makes a good point. God can only be sublime if we know that he's just, and therefore that our innocence, our moral innocence, matters. Another thing that's really interesting here is he does imply that you can enjoy the sublime if you're a guilty, rotten person. If you don't feel morally justified, then you will not experience this dynamical sublime. You will not feel, in some way, morally transcendent of the forces of nature that might press in upon you and destroy you. And I think that this therefore, provides you with a way of understanding people's characters. There are certain people who shrink away from any experience of the sublime. Why? Maybe they don't feel justified. Maybe they don't feel innocent enough to enjoy it. Schiller really doesn't bring out this aspect, but exactly, you can enjoy a sublime phenomenon that threatens you or will annihilate you if you've given up hope. Short of that, though, he says you have to be safe. Short of giving up hope, again, you have to be safe or you'll just be terrified. And so he uses this classic image that you find from Lucretius of the shipwreck of the spectator. Out at sea, a ship is foundering. Nobody on the ship is probably looking at this as an aesthetic phenomenon. They're just terrified. But the person standing on the shore, safe from the storm, looks out there and feels this shudder and this thrill at the same time. The safety of it allows them to look upon this aesthetically. And what exactly is going on? Well, on the one hand, there's an awareness of nature's power to annihilate, but on the other hand, there's an awareness of one's morality, one's moral decency, that even though one might die, one doesn't deserve it. That is an experience of the dynamics of one. In the case of inner moral security, things are completely different. The security is, of course, also a basis for putting our sensuous nature at ease. Otherwise, it would itself be sublime. But it is only indirectly through ideas of reason. We look upon the fearful without fear because we feel ourselves to be beyond the reach of its power over us as natural beings. Either through the consciousness of our innocence, or through the thoughts of the indestructibility of our being. This is the immortality. This moral security and certitude thus postulate, as we see, ideas of religion. Since only religion, not morality, sets out grounds for putting our sensuous nature at ease, morality inexorably follows the prescription of reason without any regard for the interests of our sensuous nature. Religion, however, seeks to establish a reconciliation, an agreement between the demands of reason and the inclinations of our sensuous nature. Hence, for moral security, it does not at all suffice that we possess a moral disposition. Rather, it is also necessary that we think of nature in accord with the moral law. We have to see that nature itself is subordinated to moral law, is what he's saying, in order to put ourselves at ease morally. And what's he really saying? He's saying, look, for morality to make any sense to us and to have some kind of purchase on us, we really have to recognize that morality is not some kind of absurd posture that's fundamentally out of sync with the rest of the world. If morality were something absurd in the sense that this is something that we choose to follow, but it's out of sync with reality, then why be moral at all? He's saying that in order to uphold morality, we have to represent nature as being under the same moral laws as ourselves. That way, it actually makes sense. And how do you see nature as subordinated to moral laws? Well, religion. It's a specific kind of religion, he said. That we think nature in accord with moral law, or what in this case is one of the same, that we think of nature under the sway of a pure rational being. Nature has to be under the governance of a provident good God, in other words. That is the way of reconciling ourselves morally to the world around us, is to see the world as, in some sense, moral itself, and that therefore morality is not some absurd posture in the face of an absurd meaningless universe. In order to be moral, we have to think of the world as moral, too. And the only way to think of the world as moral is to think of it as governed by a moral agent who would be God. This is the problem of evil, right? The classic problem of evil. How do you reconcile the existence of all the bad things with a good God? And Schiller is ultimately, he's pretty tough-minded on this question. He mocks the people who went on in this time and earlier who tried to show that everything, that the world is like a well-appointed hotel where everything is convenient and nice and everything works together in harmony. It's not necessarily the case that it's always already that way, but nature can be perfected, and man is its agent, so he posits a responsibility for us to justify God in a sense. But there are other theodicies, other attempts to answer the problem of evil that would say, look, and this is based on Plotinus. Plotinus argues that anything that's created has to be imperfect because it's not God. So there's an automatic evil that exists simply because things exist. Plotinus argued against the Gnostics, and what he wanted to do is he wanted to preserve a sense that the world is good, that there's something good about the world, and that the evils that exist in the world are necessary, because the only thing that can be perfect is what he called the one God, the good itself, and that anything other than the good is thereby, by that very fact, imperfect. But what about all the things that eat one another? What about all the bad stuff in the world? What about human evil? Well, in his view, he has this sort of principle of expression, which is that God creates the best of all possible worlds, and that is a world that best represents God. Of course, if God is completely simple and good, he can't really be represented by finite things. No one finite thing can be an adequate representation of God, so you have to have many of them. It's like a photo mosaic. It's like if you want to have a flat image of a three-dimensional object, how do you do it? You take lots of little snapshots and sort of lay them all out on a flat surface and have a kind of photo mosaic. You have this unified thing which has to be represented in a different dimension by many small snapshots, all of which are going to be imperfect. And the argument is that insofar as all these little snapshots are fragments and imperfect, they're going to be in conflict with one another. They're not going to overlap perfectly. It will not be perfect harmony, yet it's necessitated that there be all these things so that there's a complete representation of the good or God, the best possible thing. So if this means that, you know, lambs will be eaten by lions, and eagles will tear at the liver of Prometheus, and all this bad stuff happens, and that men will commit crimes against one another, because one way of representing the goodness of God is to have creatures of will, including the capability of things like that. I mean, so there are theodicies that try and preserve the idea that the world is good with all of the rottenness and bloodshed in it. Schiller is inclined to that view. He really wants to defend the goodness of creation. God creates something imperfect, but put it this way, it's the best of all possible worlds. The world can't be perfect, because if it were perfect, it would be God. Given that it's not God, it's got to be imperfect. The point that Schiller's trying to make, and there are many ways of arguing the point, is that, look, if we're to be good, the world has to in some way be good too. There has to be a natural fit between doing the right thing in the way the world is owned. It's hard to see that. And if you just allow that the world is just there, you're certainly not going to be able to maintain morality as anything more than a kind of brave, absurd posture in the face of an immoral world. Well, it's an imperfect world, but it's the best possible one because it's governed by a good God. That's the kind of view that he wants to defend. And he says that that's really, as he puts it, as Kant put it, a necessary postulate or assumption of practical reason. That you've got to assume something like this if the moral life makes sense. It's not just some kind of silly, radical, arbitrary choice that you make that's somewhat out of whack with the way things really are. But let's go forward. Bottom of 31, the last two lines. Death, for example, is one such object in the face of which we have only moral security. We can't prevent it, right? The only thing we've got is moral security. But he says that people find the vivid representation of death pleasurable, which means that they have some kind of moral security, although they don't have moral certainty, or they wouldn't find it fearful. So we have this kind of faith, if you will, this practical faith, or this hope that death isn't the end. Therefore, we can look upon it as an aesthetic object, as a sublime aesthetic object. So this is all, I think, fairly nicely stated. The bottom of 32, he talks about how God, to be represented as an aesthetic object, has to be good, because God is powerful, and he can annihilate us, and the only thing that we can claim against that is our innocence, but only a good God would care about innocence. Therefore, only a good God can be a sublime aesthetic object. He talks about good fortune and misfortune. Someone who overcomes what is fearful is magnificent, great. Someone who, even while succumbing to the fearful, does not fear it is sublime. Hannibal was magnificent from a theoretical point of view, since he forged a passage over the untrodden Alps of Italy. He was magnificent in a practical sense, or sublime, only in his fortune. Hercules was magnificent because he undertook and completed his 12 tasks. Prometheus was sublime because, fettered to the Caucasus, he did not regret his deed and did not acknowledge having done anything wrong. An individual can display magnificence in good fortune, sublimity only in misfortune. And Job is a sublime figure. You know, defies God. That says, you know, you wronged me. And God has to put on a real fireworks show to tell him. Prometheus is a great, great image. He's unbent. And he suffers with complete conviction of rectitude. There's something sublime about that. The only way Prometheus could experience it as sublime is if he gives up any hope of getting off that rock. If he can become disinterested or detached from it, maybe with anesthesia he can become disinterested and detached. This is what J.B. Stern said about Junger, that he was like a man describing his dissection while under anesthesia. He treated his own dissection, his own destruction as an aesthetic spectacle. And there's something creepy about that kind of detachment. But it is possible. It is possible we give up hope. Just sit back and enjoy it. Enjoy the ride. An individual can display magnificence in good fortune, sublimity only in misfortune. Hence, any object that shows us our impotence as natural beings is practically sublime, as long as it also discloses a capacity within us to resist that is of a completely different order. This capacity does not, of course, remove the danger to our physical existence, but what is infinitely more separates our physical existence from our personhood. It makes us a human being, not just the fact that we're a piece of meat. There's something more to it, some immaterial dimension to us. Hence, when something sublime is represented or entertained, we become conscious not of material security in a single instance, but rather of an ideal security extending over all possible instances. And this is why this is a fascinating moral phenomenon. These people, Kant, Schiller, thought that it really revealed something metaphysical about man. It was a phenomenon that gave us basis for assuming a kind of dualism between the physical body and the moral person, which is an extraordinary philosophical claim. And they argue that there's an aesthetic phenomenon that's a basis for this, because the best way of making sense of it is to posit this duality. I think there's something very appealing about this, and very bold. And then he sort of breaks this down into moments at the bottom of that page and the top of the next. And then he gives some nice examples. Senator of 37. an abyss appearing at our feet, a thunderstorm, a flaming volcano, a massive rock looming over us as though it were about to plunge down on us, a storm at sea, a bitter winter in the polar regions, a summer in the tropics, ferocious or poisonous animals, a flood. All these and more are the sorts of natural forces in the face of which our capacity to resist counts for nothing, natural forces that contradict our physical existence. Even certain objects, such as, for example, time, considered as a power working quietly but inexorably, necessity with its rigorous laws from which no natural being can escape, and even the moral idea of duty that behaves often enough like an inimical power toward our physical existence, become fearful objects as soon as the imagination relates them to the preservation instinct, and they become sublime as soon as reason applies them to its supreme laws. In all these cases, however, since the fantasy first adds the fearful character, and it is completely up to us to suppress an idea that we have produced ourselves, these objects belong to the class of contemplatively sublime. I think that that's sort of a nice sort of overview of it, this dynamic and contemplative notion of the sublime. He talks about silence as a sublime phenomenon. He talks about loneliness as a kind of sublime phenomenon. He talks about the role of silence, for instance, in religious ceremonies. The ancient mystery calls silence very effectively. He talks about how the indeterminate, the hidden, the mysterious, all of these are sublime phenomena one way or another. The last section is on the pathetic sublime. This really leads into his next essay, which is called On the Pathetic, and it's his most interesting discussion of tragedy. But we can't really go into that, and we've already adequately discussed it. We talked about the sublimity of suffering versus the splendor of success. So let's look at the essay by Flannery O'Connor, Some Aspects of the Grotesque in Southern Fiction. Why is it that grotesque things can become aesthetically pleasing? How is it that people enjoy David Lynch movies or Flannery O'Connor's stories? What is it about the grotesque that's appealing? Well, part of what you find appealing about the grotesque is simply that it's funny. And no matter how nice we want to be, we can always laugh at people who are grotesque. As long as we're not grotesque ourselves, right? Or as we're in denial about it, we can laugh at the grotesque, right? Fargo is a grotesque film. The Coen brothers love grotesque things generally. They're pretty good at grotesque things. It's all written off Lynch. Why is the grotesque appealing? It's a baffling question. It's not just because it's funny. It's not just because we laugh at it, because oftentimes we don't. One of my favorite examples of something grotesque is in Lynch's movie, Wild at Heart. I was in a large theater full of people, and the whole theater was just in absolute stitches. But it's not conventionally funny, and it's the kind of thing that you don't want yourself to laugh at. There's this botched robbery, and a man's hand is blown off with a shotgun, and they're searching around on the floor in the back room of the bank or the feed store where this has happened for the hand, and they're saying they could sew these things back on, and then there's blood all over the place, and this guy without a hand is searching around for his hand, and then you see a dog run out the back door with the hand in his mouth. Yeah, we shouldn't want to laugh at that, but damn it, the whole theater went up, you know, because it's just the kind of thing dogs do. But there's something grotesque about that. It's enormously funny. Now, what made you laugh? It's not just laughing, the laughter that you have at somebody who looks weird. I mean, there's something worse, there's something different about that kind of laughter. What I like about the O'Connor piece is that she tries to explain why Southern fiction writers in particular have a interest in and a talent in presenting things that are grotesque. And her fiction is filled with grotesque images. One of the things I'd like to do if we keep doing film classes is show her the movie that John Huston made of her book Wise Blood, which is a truly grotesque book, and wonderfully grotesque, well-realized film.
Her clue for the why the grotesque is popular in the South comes from Thomas Mann, who says that the grotesque is the ultimate anti-bourgeois style. And what does he mean by bourgeois? Well, and what does she see in this? Well, by bourgeois, they mean modern. And by modern, ultimately, what they mean is this modern project of the mastery of nature. And what is the mastery of nature supposed to accomplish? It's supposed to get rid of evil and suffering, make people happy. We're going to find, now that we've mapped the human genome, a way of preventing all of these grotesque, funny-looking people. Everybody will be handsome. The grotesque will be over with. The evils that exist in the world, people who commit mass murders, all these things will eventually be socially engineered away. We're going to find ways of drugging these people, or hugging these people, or talking to these people, and cajoling these people, and talking them out of their evil. And in the future, everybody will be not only beautiful in shape, but they'll also be all good, decent. We will conquer disease, we will abolish money, we will all be sailing through the galaxy in the Starship Enterprise. We will no longer be greedy, we won't enslave animals for food. We'll just get things out of the replicator. So this is the modern vision of things, this progressive enlightenment, technological modernity, that is referred to by this term bourgeois. Now, the reason why Southern writers in particular find the grotesque appealing is that the grotesque is anti-bourgeois. And what does that mean? What O'Connor tries to do in her works is she tries to confront people who have this modernistic mindset with things that are just too weird and misshapen to possibly be straightened out by any amount of social science, social engineering. And also she tries to show you evil behavior that is just so inexplicable and singular and ghastly that you can't imagine a way of ameliorating it or getting rid of it by social science and social engineering. And for her, it's ultimately in the service of her own theological worldview. She's Catholic. And so in her view, the grotesque is popular in Southern fiction. Page 44 is a nice passage. Just below the center, she says, "Whenever I'm asked why Southern writers particularly have a penchant for writing about freaks, I say it is because we are still able to recognize them. To be able to recognize a freak, you have to have some conception of the whole man, and in the South, the general conception of men is still in the main theological. That is a large statement, and it is dangerous to make it. And for almost anything you say about Southern belief can be denied in the next breath of propriety. But approaching the subject from the standpoint of the writer, I think it is safe to say that while the South is hardly Christ-centered, it is most certainly Christ-haunted. The Southerner who isn't convinced of it is very much afraid that he may have been formed in the image and likeness of God. Ghosts can be very fierce and destructive. They cast strange shadows, particularly in our literature." She goes on in this vein a while longer, and she talks about how, because of this outlook, which is essentially theological, she finds it impossible to believe that human beings, by their own efforts, are ever going to make themselves good and beautiful. She thinks that it's not man's power to do this, and she thinks that most Southern writers who have an inclination for the grotesque share this basic theological worldview. And therefore, what they do in showing, confronting people with grotesque images and inexplicable forms of behavior, is they're trying to shock people out of this complacent optimism. And she's very much opposed to naturalism in the modern sense. Modern naturalism in fiction is really very much connected with 19th century progressivism and social science. You know, the naturalists were the first novelists who looked at statistics and tried to capture the way people actually live in the slum and tried to write books of social significance that would affect people. You know, Dickens was one of these Zola. Books that are really there because they have a social message. They want to produce a social reform, raise consciousness, things like this. And O'Connor describes people like this as optimists who think of the writer as just the handmaiden of the age, right? The handmaiden of progress. She doesn't share their optimism. Therefore, she writes in a way that tries to undermine and shock people out of that optimism. And the fact that people respond to it, and our books are, and stories are comic, although it's very dark comedy, is because on some level they have a sense that things are not always so easy to fix or easy to understand. And the grotesque is an aesthetically appealing phenomenon because it's a way of sort of enjoying the crookedness of the world and the inexplicability of things. So it's funny when that dog runs out of the back of the store with the man's hand in his mouth, because on some level, people have a feeling that they sew those things back on today. That's a kind of false hope. There's something silly about putting too much hope in that. Because I know there's a damn dog who's going to run away with it. There's a Kurosawa movie, I think it's Jimbo, where the samurai comes to town and there's two gangs fighting. The first thing he sees when he comes into the town is a dog running along with a human hand in its mouth. Lynch is paying homage to that. But it's not as funny in the samurai movie as it is in the Lynch movie. Precisely because of the juxtaposition between the guys saying, they can sew these things back on, and the dog running off with the hand. You don't see that grotesque juxtaposition, or that grotesque sort of frustration of the desire to master things. The sublime enchants and attracts us precisely because of our thought that we are morally superior to nature. The grotesque attracts and enchants and draws people in because of the sense that although we might be morally superior to nature, we might not be physically equal to the challenge. That sort of sums up O'Connor's view of the grotesque. Aside from a particular theological perspective, really the grotesque is that which frustrates our optimism, if you will, and reminds us of our limits. And we live in a world where we're less and less reconciled to limits because of technology, progress, optimism, and that sort. And therefore the grotesque is all the more useful in a way. It's all the more balancing. She talked about a realism of distances, which I think is kind of interesting. The artist has to be a realist. The thing that she objects to about the naturalists is in some way they're not naturalistic enough, because they really only portray things that sort of fit in with their presuppositions, mm-hmm. right? Their optimistic presuppositions. Whereas in fact, if you're really a naturalist, one of the things you have to confront is precisely the limits of your own worldview rather than the things that confirm it. That's what she's really trying to do. And people say her stories aren't realistic. They're terribly realistic. They're not average. Ted Bundy wasn't an average guy, but he was certainly real. John Wayne Gacy wasn't your average guy. But it's precisely by confronting these bizarre and perverted characters that you really get a sense of the limits of things, rather than the vast averages, the statistical middle of the roads. My favorite scene in Fargo that just sort of left me cracking up was the idiot buries all this money in the snow by the side of the road, and then to mark it, puts a little scraper there, and then the camera pans down this way, and there's this infinite fence that all looks the same for as far as the eye can see, and it pans the other way, and there's this infinite fence as far as the eye can see, looking exactly the same, and this idiot thinks that he's going to be able to find his little windshield scraper out there as a marker. It was just absurd. Well, the reason why we feel that we shouldn't laugh at this is because we're still holding to the hope that we can make everything good and better, right? I really think so. And there's some people who just won't. The extremely politically correct simply won't laugh at certain things. Alexei Sale was British comedians' parents were these Stalinists, and he talked about how whenever he was around them and somebody would crack a joke, it was like making a very long distance phone call, because the joke would be made and then there'd be this long silence while they were thinking, should they be willing to laugh at this? Is it proper for them to laugh at this? They had to pass everything by this internal censor who would stamp things that funny or not, and then they would laugh if it was permitted. And then a lot of times they would. P.J. O'Rourke, who's a very very naughty comic writer, talks about how there are people who say that Helen Keller jokes aren't funny. He said these people are just full of it. Of course they're funny. these people just don't think that they should laugh at them. They ought not to be funny, perhaps they are. And the grotesque is funny, and it is pleasurable, even though our awareness of it is caught up with our awareness of our own limitations.